Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. What does it take to create a truly equitable healthcare system? From entrepreneurs to investors to community workers from across the globe, this season we're speaking to the people aligning capital and technology to find the answer. This episode is produced in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation as part of a series investigating the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the global healthcare sector. My guest today is Caitlin Dolcott, co-founder and managing director at Flare. Caitlin, who is originally from Chicago, is passionate about solving the world's largest healthcare problems. Prior to co-founding Flare in 2016, Caitlin worked in management consulting and spent years as a director of the Clinton Foundation, leading their malaria work throughout sub-Saharan Africa. She has her MBA from MIT's Sloan School of Management. Welcome, Caitlin.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here today.
So tell us about Flare. It was originally founded in response to the lack of a centralized healthcare emergency response system in Kenya. What first drew your attention to the serious issue, and how did that inspire you to create it?
So I have been in East Africa and living in Nairobi for the last decade and working in healthcare and within healthcare systems. And I think that one of the first things that I started to realize is that some of the most obvious or basic healthcare systems that places like the UK or the US, where I'm originally from, take for granted. And one such system is 911 or 999. And I think at first it was the simplicity of such a system that drew me to it. Later did I learn how complex it is to build, operate, and run a 911 system. But I think the fact was that it was such an easy concept for someone to understand that in an emergency, you should only have one number to call, and that number should respond, and you should have services quickly. And so Maria and I, who founded the company, believed and continue to do so that we can solve that problem, where 50% of the world does not have access to a 911 system like in Kenya, where we've been operating.
So you've been dubbed the Uber for ambulances by the African startup ecosystem. And so tell us exactly how Flare works and what impact your services is having on emergency response.
Yeah, the analogy with Uber for ambulances is such a convenient and helpful one, because when we started in Nairobi, Uber had just launched. And so the concept of on-demand services, you know, was well understood. And so it quickly caught on when we started to do something similar. So the way that it works, which is quite different than Uber, is that we say that there's really two main parts to it. There's the technology, and then there's the humans. So on the technology front, what we do is that we have brought together an incredibly fragmented system. So while there was no 911, there's hundreds of ambulances throughout Kenya, far enough to actually provide emergency services. It's just that they're independently operated. And so through our technology, using, you know, an app and vehicle and the ambulances, we string them together into a network that functions as one. Today in Kenya, what happens is that there's a single phone call. That phone call is routed to our 24/7 dispatch center. Our dispatchers leverage our Flare technology. They're, with a touch of a button, able to dispatch an ambulance, and that ambulance arrives on scene in minutes. So what used to take literally potentially hundreds of calls takes one. What used to take 3 hours now takes 15 minutes. So we're inching closer and closer to meeting global standards and being just as fast as, you know, London or New York City or Chicago, where I originally come from.
Sounds extraordinary. So to access Flare, individuals need to sign up to an annual membership service. And tell us, how much does this cost, and how do you ensure that everyone has access to your life-saving services and not just those who can afford it?
I'll go back to kind of a question you asked before about saying that we're the Uber for ambulances. So I'd say this is where we veer away from being like Uber. It's one of the first things that we recognize, that is in an emergency, the last thing that you need to be dealing with is payment. Payment can't be a part of the conversation. It will delay the care and unfortunately, hurt the chances of survival of that patient. And so a membership model is much like a utility or a tax. Like, think about paying for your internet. Nowadays, you can't imagine not having internet at your home or work. And so that's what we're trying to kind of shift the mindset around. So it's like a social insurance where you pay a very small amount. It's about $2 per month, and it covers you fully. It's actually built off of a similar model that we really loved and learned about from Australia that works quite well. And so the way, though, that we ensure that everyone has access, no matter if you can pay for it, is that it's a cross-subsidy. So we include in that membership a portion for individuals who are unable to pay for those services.
So how do you scale this? What are your ambitions to grow FLAN? And how do you see its reach and impact expanding and evolving? Because it's obviously such an important and innovative way of delivering emergency care to those people who need it.
When we think about scale, we think about it in a few different parameters. I mean, one is just scaling to make sure that we're reaching more and more patients every single year who have emergencies. About 3% of a population have an emergency. And it seems like a small percent when you start multiplying it by, you know, for example, 50 million people, which is the population in Kenya. Those numbers are no longer small. I mean, we're talking about millions of emergencies per annum. So part of our scaling is just to make sure that we can reach the remotest corners of the country, that we have a network that is well distributed and that doesn't just operate in Nairobi, the capital city in Kenya, but can get into, you know, more remote areas. But beyond Kenya, I think one of the things, you know, early on when you're an entrepreneur, you think about, you know, a problem as very localized, is like, this is a local issue in Kenya or Nairobi. But you start to zoom out and you realize that 95% of Africa doesn't have a 911 system. And so for us, that's where we see the bigger opportunity, is that how can we build replicable technology and systems such that we can start to move into and grow to the, you know, largest cities and countries on the continent, you know, country by country.
So what would it take to make that happen? If I were a magician who could wave a wand and give you what you needed to allow you to match both your ambitions and your ability to radically improve people's lives and the impediments to you scaling, what would it take? What do you need?
I would say the trifecta, as we call it: money, people, and partners. So money, like, we have to, you know, I think an interesting part of our company, we think of our technology as an infrastructure. So it's kind of like when you build physical infrastructure, you have to raise the money up front, and you have to build a good foundation that doesn't crack. And if you want it to be several stories high, you need to really invest in what you're building. And so for us, it is actually quite important that you have the right amount of capital to invest in the technology. 911 is a system that you never want to hear on the, you know, breaking news, 911 is down, you know, people can't get emergency services. So our technology is super resilient, redundant, and we've spent quite a bit of money just on building that technology to be as robust as possible. So that's money. But back to the other part of our company, is it's all about the humans, is that you want the best people behind the technology and the systems. These are individuals that hold, you know, your life in their hands, and they've got a massive responsibility to leverage the technology that we've built, and also need to be super creative, because systems are not perfectly, you know, connected or attached, and they're constantly on their toes and thinking about, like, how do I get this person into this hospital, or what do I do now? And then the last is partners, is everything that we have built. Remember, because we're kind of like Uber, we don't actually own the ambulances and we don't own hospitals. So we depend on the healthcare system that already exists. And we call them our heroes, because these are everyday individuals that are every day in the front lines of healthcare, never recognized, never supported, never integrated into a network. And so for us, a lot of our work is about the partners we build in every single city or country where we operate. And we give a lot of credit to the work that they do to be able to allow us to then deliver the service.
So how difficult is it to strike those partnership agreements or find aligned partners, and what are the difficulties but also the delights of establishing those partnerships?
One thing that we initially, you know, confronted is that when you have a fragmented healthcare system, the question that everyone has is like, what's in it for me to participate in a more coordinated system? And does that not just equalize everyone's chance of competing? And remember, we're working predominantly with private healthcare providers. And so, you know, while they are, you know, delivering social impact, they also are thinking about how do I make this, you know, financially sustainable. And, you know, the way that we got around that kind of in the early days is that we were able to, you know, demonstrate to them that by being together, we are actually stronger, is that their businesses were in jeopardy already if they did not participate. And showing them both financially as well as operationally how our technology and how our systems benefited them. I think that the important thing with partnership is everyone has to have skin in the game. Everyone has to be aligned on the vision. And a lot of what we had to do early on was to kind of demonstrate that in order to kind of jumpstart, you know, the market.
I want to ask you how you track and measure your impact, because I'm sure you have some significant kind of statistical accounts of how you've saved people's lives. But there's also the qualitative aspect of this, of the storytelling and the individual people who are mothers and fathers and daughters and sons whose lives you have impacted. Can you tell us a little bit about how both qualitatively and quantitatively you track your impacts and you tell your stories?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think you make such a good point. It's very much about, you know, we are numbers driven. Everything in emergency response, we say we're the logistics of all logistics because we're moving humans. And so everything has a timestamp, is tracked, is, you know, operationally analyzed. But that said, you can't lose sight of the fact that every single emergency response is touching an individual's life. And so it is about kind of coupling those two strategies together. On the operational front, there's a number of things that we look at, but the most significant one is coined in healthcare the golden hour. So following a traumatic injury or emergency, the chance of you surviving and lowering the chance of also disability is if you can get to care in under an hour. And a lot has to happen in order for that to occur. So that's a well kind of documented, studied piece of literature showing the impact of survival. So in Kenya, before we started, 1 in 10 died in an emergency. In the UK or the US, where you have a 911 system, 1 in 100 die. Of course, there's always emergencies you can't prevent or you can't, even with fast response, save. So that just shows you how time is everything. So we measure time in every imaginable way to see how are we constantly improving more and more. But I think on the like more personal side is we share a lot of stories and testimonials. So as an example, someone who we recently helped. So in Kenya during COVID, there's been an ongoing curfew. And this has been in place since March. So we're running on almost 6 months of a curfew. So from the hours of, you know, 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., you can't move around or you risk being arrested. And every single night, there's 2,500 babies born in Kenya. So you scratch your head and you say, how do those women get to the hospital? How are they going to deliver? And what's going to happen if women start delivering at the home versus in a skilled healthcare facility? So one mother that we recently helped, and a big role that we've had during the pandemic is actually ensuring that women have safe transport and effective transport to get to the hospital during those curfew hours. So one woman we recently helped, she was recounting to us afterwards just how, you know, she couldn't even express how much it meant to her to be able to safely get to the hospital. She had miscarried on her first child, and she was really nervous her entire pregnancy about carrying her second baby. And we were able to get an ambulance to her and get her to a hospital in plenty of time to safely deliver. And so there's thousands of stories like that from every single person that we've helped. But I think that's a story that is, you know, really relevant to today, because we're all still coping with the effects, whether that be direct or secondary, of COVID.
just hearing you tell that story just illustrates how powerful and important it is for those people working in social impact space to tell stories and put narrative behind their numbers, because it brings it home, the real human impact of what you do. And speaking of which, you mentioned the curfew and the impact of COVID-19 on Kenya and therefore on your work. What have you had to do? How have you had to respond? What innovations have you put in place in order to deal with the pandemic?
COVID-19 has been very different in Kenya than a lot of the rest of the world, whether that be Europe or the US, is that, you know, thankfully we haven't had such an enormous number of cases. That said, none of that was known, you know, back in March. And so the first thing that we did was prepare, because everything needs to, you know, prepare, over-prepare, especially in emergency situations. So a lot of our work in the early days was just making sure that all of our ambulances were trained on what to do, how to safely handle COVID patients. And that's no small undertaking. When you think about like the thousands of individuals who are at the front lines responding, you know, that's a lot of people to quickly train. So we did a lot of digital education to be able to disseminate very quickly that information, distributed through our Flare app, which they have in vehicle. We ensured that they had proper PPE to keep them safe, such that, you know, they were not at risk. But over the last several months, it's actually really evolved. So we continue to, you know, respond to suspected or confirmed COVID patients, making sure that we provide ambulance services to get them to the hospital. But a lot of what we've actually had to deal with is what we call the secondary effect. So there's been a huge economic impact here. And what that means is that people are not seeking regular healthcare or accessing preventative care or primary healthcare. And so we've seen a big surge of mental health cases because of the economic issues, as well as just not, you know, regularly seeing or attending your appointments. A number of diabetic patients who just also aren't regulating. So chronic conditions, as well as maternity cases. Back to the story of, you know, the mother who had to deliver in the middle of the night. There's 2,500 mothers every single night. So if you think about that over the last 6 months, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of babies were born.
You mentioned earlier that you're a technology that is an interface between, you know, people and machinery, equipment, logistics, getting people who are in need of care to services. And obviously the crucial spoke in all of that are the emergency responders themselves. How have you designed Flare to take into account their particular needs and concerns, so it's sort of designed with them in mind? What features and innovations and adaptations have you put in place to serve their needs?
Yeah, that's such an important point, just in general of technology design. I've always make sure to work with the user on the product, because you can have this amazing vision, but then, you know, you put it into the hands and you realize it doesn't work. And so I think the most important thing that we harnessed was that in an emergency, there's not a lot of time. And even if you've handled thousands of emergencies, everyone is a little bit different. And everyone, you know, is high stress, high anxiety, no room for error. And so in designing our technology, we think a lot and work with our ambulance teams and partners to make sure that the app is super easy to use, super simple. So the interface is not tons of buttons and bells and whistles and easy to kind of navigate, and provides them the tools that makes their job easier. So a couple of features, as an example, I'll provide, is that one of the, you know, things that people always talk about in Nairobi or emerging markets is there's no addresses. You know, there aren't direct, you know, points that you can go to. And oftentimes directions are, you know, follow this road and then at this big tree, take a right. And when you see this sign, take a left. And so they're narrations rather than actual locations. And so a lot of the tools that we've put into the app are about navigation and how do you get to the patient most efficiently. Also, traffic is a huge issue. So it's also about using, you know, we leverage Google Maps and traffic data to be able to assist them to get to the patient faster. So that's one example of like a feature that's super important to them that really helps them do their job, And it makes it much stickier because they love that. They want to be able to get to the patient faster. They want to know how to get there. And they don't want to have to be on the phone back and forth saying, okay, which tree was it? And so using, you know, today's technology, we're able to kind of cut out all of that for them. And there's several more features like, you know, a hospital directory, because every patient has to be delivered to a hospital. So if you put every single hospital's number in the app, you know, they can quickly alert them that, hey, I'm en route, please prepare, and I've got patient XYZ. So there's many, many more like that, but all of the features are simple, easy to use, and benefit them to save time and improve their chance of saving that individual's life.
I want to ask a system design question of you. One level, getting people who are in an emergency to a healthcare facility has to self-evidently be a good thing. But you also, we also know that the provision of primary healthcare workers to community members helps in prevention and helps to stop the use of emergency facilities for what would otherwise be conditions that could be prevented if you had a proper community-based healthcare system that focused on prevention rather than waiting till an ailment or a condition becomes an emergency. And so to what extent do you view yourself as part of an effort to stop emergencies from occurring or building a healthcare system that isn't overly oriented to emergency response?
That's a very interesting and relevant question. I mean, I think we've thought a lot about, especially now during COVID, how we can, you know, because we are such a trusted resource, how do we offer, you know, telemedicine or other services kind of upstream, as we say, to prevent that from happening? That said, I would say that the kind of types of cases that we deal with are really different than what you see in the US and Europe, is that a very, very large percentage of the cases that we deal with are traumatic injuries and accidents, road accidents. And so I think that, you know, beyond other kind of services that we could provide to the patient, some of it is structural changes. So as an example, if we know that there's certain black spots on major highways, how do we actually work with the government to better identify those areas or to improve those areas to ensure that they have walkways or bridges, because a lot of the accidents are pedestrians being hit. So I think we are constantly thinking about, you know, not only at a healthcare level, but also at a systems level, how do you start to change the system around you to prevent those emergencies from happening as well?
Let me ask the same question in a slightly different way. So let's assume, which I do, that you become wildly efficient. You help provide life-saving assistance to people within the golden hour. And because of Flair, 2x or 3x the number of people are landing up in emergency rooms requiring treatments in circumstances prior to you where people might die on the road without an ambulance arriving in time, and therefore people are being taken to the mortuary and not to an emergency room. So you must create greater demand. Have you seen that happen, and what have you been able to do to help create sufficient emergency health workers to be able to provide assistance to the people you bring to them through your services?
Such a fascinating question, and I think just like a testament to how every single healthcare company like ours or initiative has to think about the broader system. So for us, kind of going back to the whole analogy of Uber, because we've been using it along the way, is Ubers can drop you anywhere. They can drop you home, they can drop you at work, they can drop you at a hospital. But for us, conveniently, you know, the destination is always a hospital. And those are fixed locations. And so one of the things that we have spent a ton of time doing is building partnerships with hospitals. And what that means is that we understand the capacity, the capability, the availability of those services. such that we aren't, you know, clogging a hospital with, you know, way too many patients for them, and also that we're not sending patients to places that they can't even receive care. One of the top reasons that people call us are road accidents. Road accidents often include head trauma or some type of trauma that require, you know, diagnostics like an MRI or CT scan to understand, is there internal bleeding? So we have had to map the entire healthcare system and understand what services exist such that we're always sending patients to a place that has those services. So we would never send you in that scenario to a hospital that doesn't have a CT scan. And so it is critical to our success that we actually work with all the different hospitals to be able to, similarly to what we've done on the ambulance side, bring them into one centralized system such that you can always push patients from one facility to next when there's overflow or when there's available services. This was certainly highlighted during COVID when there's a shortage of ventilators. Everyone was talking about that, you know, in every country, there's not enough ventilators. Here, though, there's only a couple hundred. And so, you know, it was critical for us to understand which facilities had available ventilators such that we were able to match the patient to the right facility. But you're exactly right, is you have to think about one step further, is that it's fantastic that we got you a fast ambulance, we're on scene in 15 minutes. But if we fall short of not getting you admitted to the right hospital, then what was the point of us having sirens blaring, you know, and going all out to save your life?
You know, this interview has really changed the way I think about what you do, because on first blush, it may seem like you are an emergency response or logistics company, but what you are properly understood is really a kind of data analytics company in some ways, because you can identify the black spots on the highways where the most deadly accidents occur. You can also identify places in the healthcare system where there is a mismatch between what patients need and the capacity to deliver care to them. So in some ways, you become this wildly valuable and important diagnostic tool to allow those in positions of power to address critical infrastructure to improve the well-being of their citizens. Is that in some ways how you think of yourself?
We think of emergency response as the heartbeat of healthcare. And the reason that we say that is because we get everything and we can actually understand how well a system is functioning. And that allows us to really understand what other interventions may be needed as a result of that. So we're definitely the heartbeat of healthcare and understand kind of where and what is happening in the healthcare system. Because when you have an emergency, you have no other choice and you really need to receive services and care. And so that's when healthcare is actually challenged. And, you know, you're asking, can I actually get that care? Can I receive that care? It's always easier if you plan ahead of time that you want to see a doctor and, you know, work through the system that way. But if it's an emergency, everything has to work in lockstep and understanding what kind of levers you need to pull to be able to make that happen allows you to have that kind of analytical approach.
So listening to you makes me think that this is such a valuable service. You have it thoroughly under control and everything works perfectly. And I'm sure en route you have 100 difficult stories to tell from where you started to where you've got to. And every entrepreneur has 100 stories of trial and challenge and difficulty. So tell us a really hard story about what it took from you to get to from where you started to where you are now.
There are so many stories to tell as it relates to kind of the struggles, whether it be, you know, convincing the global community and investors that this was worth investing in, that, you know, private sector and social enterprises have a role to play in shaping emergency response, because oftentimes 911 is thought of as a public good, a public service. This should be something the government does. So I would say a lot of it was initially convincing. Once we, though, got past that, everyone quickly sees the value of it and understands it. But I think it's not, while I paint this picture of kind of perfect operations and logistics, and we've come an incredibly far way, is there still are so many, you know, difficulties, you know, within the system that you have to kind of confront every single day. And so I remember like one, you know, particular night, our dispatch system, we had always said, you know, it needs to work offline. You need to be able to have it mobile based because what if electricity goes down? So our office, we have three different internet sources. We have three different power sources. And of course, all went down on one single night. And so we dispatched a case in candlelight, but we had our app. It was working. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, if anything, I think the environment has made us become unbelievably resilient and constantly think about kind of what is that next, you know, disaster or what is that next, you know, event that we have to deal with. In the history of FLAIR, we have dealt with, you know, from the 2017 election, presidential elections, there was post-violence. To the Doosan terror attack, to now a global pandemic. So I really, you can never, you don't know what's coming in emergency response, but I think we are definitely constantly on our toes and never complacent to the fact that, you know, we have done this successfully thousands of times because every day there's a new twist, there's a new turn, there's a new protocol that we have to develop.
Let's presume you were the Minister of Health for a day and you could make a change to the healthcare system based on what you know now that would result in better outcomes or greater equity. Just give us a sense of, if you could just make one change, what would that be?
I mean, there's a lot of changes that I would make, but one that I would change immediately is to pay healthcare workers more.
And in a world where you see so many casualties and accidents, and I should imagine, although you save thousands of lives, you also see tragedy. What is it that gives you hope? What is it that makes you wake up in the morning and continue to come to work and to execute, build your business and execute your mission?
With every single hard case, there's also, you know, a super inspiring case or one that makes you happy. And so emergencies are not always all bad. You know, as I said, sometimes it's carrying expectant moms who, like, their water has broken and they're about to deliver a new baby and welcome a new life to the world. But I think that every single, we make sure on a weekly basis, we review challenging cases, but we also review the successful cases. So we've, you know, had various celebrations along the way, whether it was, you know, early on, it was, you know, reaching our 500th patient. Now it's like reaching our, you know, 10,000th patient. Or when we met a response time of 2 minutes, meaning we got the call and the ambulance was there in 2 minutes. So we try to celebrate those little moments because those are so important to demonstrating that our system works and continuously works. But on the side of, you know, difficult cases, I do think a lot of that, and it's been shown in emergency response, it's one of the most stressful positions, is to be an emergency responder, is to be at the dispatch and be at the helm of, you know, coordinating and making sure that that case happens correctly. So a lot of what we do is also to make sure that we have the right support networks within our organization to really aid them and make sure that they're supported as well.
The final question, you've obviously made an enormous positive contribution to the world of healthcare. And if somebody is listening to this podcast, says, I'd like to be like that, I'd like to make my own contribution, what advice would you give to them? How should they go about doing it?
Very broad question, but I would say just start. As I think with healthcare, it can become this web of confusion of where do you begin? And similar to kind of going back to our story, is that you can't fix everything at once. And so while we wanted to fix the coordination and dispatching of ambulance services and ensure that they're centralized, we can't overnight make sure that every ambulance looks as beautiful as the London Ambulance Service, or we can't guarantee that every hospital in Kenya has a cardiologist. But you have to begin somewhere and start to bite off that problem bit by bit And by doing that, you start to solve the other bigger problems alongside it. And so my suggestion is just start and don't think about all of the kind of waterfall effects as of yet, because that will kind of come out, you know, as you start to solve it.
I couldn't agree more. I think there is enormous virtue in just doing it. If you care and want to make a difference, start and you'll figure out a way. For everything that you do, for everything that Flair does, for your contribution to Kenya, but also to creating a more equitable global healthcare infrastructure, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this today.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation, please visit chwi.jnj.com. And for more information on the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.